companions. We help you discover your many layers. You peel, you cry, you wake up with fresh eyes. Question life, question humanity, question society, but most of all, question yourself.
Hello, my name is Orede Thaka. I am a Nigerian, British-born community artist living in London. I am also a mother of a teenager. And my work is centered around stories, place, and identity. I have my own arts organization, which is a social enterprise called ROCKS International Arts. ROCKS is an acronym for responsibility, ownership, confidence, knowledge, and self-awareness. These are all principles and values that I believe art instills and can build within people. And I think through that, social change can be empowered, particularly in communities who are often marginalized or whose stories and voices are controlled by others and not necessarily by themselves. I think that's it, yeah.
You know what, I think there is a lot in there, also because you emphasize on identity, and I can very clearly hear that your experiences and the social political of that context and history that goes, you know, way beyond just your lifetime and probably even further before, it has an influence in your work and your experiences. And there is a lot in there that we'll unpack with the conversation. But let's start with something a bit lighter. So the Wayfinder project, that's the artist composer residency that we're both working on, and it sort of start coming to a close soon. But would you be able to share what you did for the residency?
Yeah. So my creative response to the first tuning in resources that we were given for the Wayfinder I wrote a folk tale, and I painted, so my response was to write a folk tale and to paint and sculpt. My folk tale is called The Folk Tale of 2020. And as I was reading and just reflecting upon the work that had been gathered so far, it's kind of interesting. So my way of being able to deal with heavy emotions is to write it down. And it kind of felt like when we look back, and it was surreal as well, like looking back, and even it still is surreal because it's not like it. You went into 2021 and automatically, it's a new year, it's a new day, you know, it's not like The Wiz. And and then just thinking about the context of the Wayfinder, and the Wayfinder almost became this mythical energy, this mythical being. And I just kept, and what I got from the voices and the people that contributed was like this primordial sense of community and healing, kind of like almost like, I remember having a conversation with my brother about, you know, this utopian world, and in this utopian world there would be these healers that the leaders of nations would go to like, you know, the healers and the scribes, they would, like, particularly the healers, though, like, they would go to the healers and find out, okay, there's something wrong with within our nation. What do we need to do? They would consult these people. And the contributors to the Wayfinder, for me, like, their selfless acts of, you know, doing what they needed to do for their communities kind of spoke of that. It's like, it hasn't. And whether people are conscious that what they're doing is embodying the healers of villages and nations that we always would read about in these mythical stories or these folk tales, like the wise men, the wise women, you know, there were these elders, these beings who knew instinctively what needed to happen to heal and to move forward and would gather in whatever, you know, in whatever shape or form, whether, you know, you've got warriors of different capacities as well, not just warriors in terms of warriors that we have come to understand being as soldiers, but you've got the warriors who can defend a community in various ways. And that kind of like started to weave a story in my mind, like as the Wayfinder is this kind of wave of energy that is eternal but isn't quite easy to explain, but there is this sense that in every age there comes a time when this Wayfinder will come along and stirs up and empowers in a way that is unusual, and then will just disappear again. It's like, you know, like a wave comes and it goes. So that became the seed for the tale of 2020. So like, if I could write 2020 as a folk tale, and if I could write the experiences as, and also like folk tales and parables, they also do act as a wayfinder. They're like a path that reminds us of a time, and there's like a message and there's a lesson in there. It's like, well, what would be, you know, 2020 definitely needs that kind of folk tale that in years to come, when it's read, people will remember that these experiences happened. And then in terms of my visual representation, I kept seeing trees a lot, but then I always tend to see trees. When it comes to like my own personal work, I tend to do a lot of natural things to do around nature. And my daughter often says, oh, it's a tree. You're always drawing trees. Something, there's always trees involved in something, whatever I'm doing. And I went out for a walk one day. I live near Richmond Park, and there was one evening after work, I'd just gone out, and I was just, there is definitely something for me about being around trees. And I just was sitting at this tree, at the base of a tree that was overlooking the park. And it was an old tree that had been cut down, and it was no longer fruitful. So it was, yeah, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like, oh, because it was winter that the leaves had gone. No, this tree had died. But it was an ancient tree. It looked like, you know, it'd been there for years and years and years and years. And it was just like, I was just sitting there, just thinking, like, how much it's seen over the years of the comings and the goings. And I started to think about the nature of trees. And, you know, through our way of life being change and being restricted, where people weren't going out so much anymore. They were going out for walks, and they, you know, it reconnected people with a lot of nature. And there was like research showing that nature had also responded more positively to the, you know, less air pollution and all of that. And I just started to think about the different trees in the different countries where these wayfinder dining duets were taking place. And so, well, what would be the linkage? What could link all of them? And I started to research indigenous trees to Mexico, Barcelona, Japan, South Korea, South Africa, UK, and North America. And there were these indigenous trees, and these indigenous trees, they, again, going back to like ancient times, they were trees that were quite important to their communities and their cultures. And then that kind of like started taking me down this rabbit hole, and I found out about the mother tree. And it's quite interesting. So, you know, trees, we all know that trees communicate, and we all know that trees are healing. But I didn't know and understand the extent to which that was true through the mother tree. So within each kind of like forest, there is this mother tree, and the mother tree is the one who communicates and shares information to all of the trees. Doesn't matter of their species, it's not, she doesn't just communicate to trees of her species. She's there to nourish and nurture. So she draws in the nutrients and she gives out the nutrients to every single tree that's in that forest. And I was like, wow. And it's a shared wisdom, and it's a shared, and they do. And so she's like the anchor. And then they all do the same, you know, they all do the same thing. There's this underground communication that takes place. And, you know, in there you've got life and you've got birth, and there's no such thing, like, there's no such thing within nature of being fearful of death and the changing of the seasons. It's all natural, because you don't, obviously we don't hear of like it, you know, a tree doesn't get upset or grieved. I'm not saying that we shouldn't, but like in terms of nature, a tree gives birth, buds new seeds, and those seeds flower, and then animals come and eat those, you know. There's all there's a lot of giving, and there's also a lot of receiving as well. And then the tree goes through the cycle of death, all the leaves fall away, but there is that knowing that it's just a continual thing. It's a continual cycle. And that, again, I felt kind of like was the embodiment of what, again, the stories of in the tuning in the, you know, in the dining duets. This is what they were doing again. It's like these people, you know, they became the mother trees for their communities. They were giving and then they were receiving. And it was all a lot. It does, you know, it does take its toll. And over years, it does take its toll on the mother tree till eventually she will die. But, you know, they're just this, I just became really fascinated by that. And I found a book, and I started reading up about it. So it was a book called The Hidden Life of Trees by Peter Wallenben. And I've just started reading it. It's really just fascinating to realize how we are all connected. And again, going back to what I was saying about this utopian time and this ancient time where we were all connected. When I say we were all connected, it's like human beings, we coexisted with nature in a way that was respectful, I believe. And over time, we've become disconnected from that. And I think last year, with people recognizing that this, the lifestyle that we were living in terms of this work life, and because that became our life. We're born, we study, we work. Some are able to retire and maybe have some form of a leisure life, but most don't. And being forced to stop again, a lot, some were able to reflect and spend more time out in nature. And we also, in last year brought out a lot in terms of forest fires as well. I know, it's just like there was a lot to reflect about last year and going through it. And I don't know if you've kind of felt that as well, like you couldn't disengage from the work, from what you were creating, like, because you're also living through the same thing, the empathy wasn't just empathy that I felt with the Dine and Duets. I could relate to it in a real tangible way, because we were all in some shape or form really deeply affected by this pandemic.
It's really interesting because so recently at Lunar New Year, I met my cousin's kid. So she is 14 this year, and I showed her my film Wayfinding, and then I asked how she felt after the film. She became really serious and silent after the film, and then she was saying that it's very uncomfortable, and she didn't want to watch the front part because it was intense and it was kind of scary, and then I was quite surprised, because I mean the last few times I saw her, she was just like, a primary school kid. But she said, obviously, because I'm still in school, like I don't experience the full experience that adults go through who might have lost their jobs and all of that. And it was just sort of like further emphasizing on that reflection of mine where, if kids find that uncomfortable and scary, then really for adults, that's also an acknowledgement that what we've been through was something that was very uncertain, that was very scary, and that was super uncomfortable. And we survived it. I mean, even though we're still in it. But, and then also just sort of like, I've been reflecting on like the healers in this world, right? And in indigenous cultures, native cultures, it feels like the role of a healer, it's so central to communities. Yet the experience that we have now of a healer, maybe it's a therapist or a social worker or counselor, it feels almost like a very commodified experience. And then when you talk about stuff like bringing communities together, opening up safe spaces for vulnerability, for sharing, for stories to be told and heard, the sort of like metrics-driven world and system says, this is idealistic. Like, what is your business plan? What is your business model? Like, how are you going to earn money out of that? Do people want to engage? Why would they want to spend time? Like, why would they want to spend money to do something like that? And, it's like there is such a big disconnect. It's like a chicken and egg thing where, right, you're working to be able to survive, to pay your bills, pay your mortgage or whatever. And then yet that doesn't leave you time to engage with anything that's deeper, anything that connects, anything that makes you feel vulnerable, that actually helps you to build relationships and communities. And then people end up spending a lot of stuff on consumerism, buying things that they don't need. But then, it's desire that is played out through advertisements and all of that. And I don't know, it feels like it's very uncomfortable. Yet, as you said, you know, these healers in the dine arounds, or like the people who are all over the world trying to do something, make a difference, make a change in this world, it's so difficult to do so. It's like, it's something that's essential to us as humans, because that's what we need. Yet we have to fight the system to be able to do so. And it's like, why, how have we built a system that isn't really serving us, you know?
And I think it does boil down to, and I'm no expert in this, but there's a lot that we are experiencing in our time based on ideals that no longer, like you said, they no longer serve us, but because they've been around for centuries, there is this resistance, there's this inability to stop it and realize that actually it's not serving us, and it's not unique to any particular place. Like, I think globally, everywhere around the world, we are existing on, based on colonialism, imperialism, capitalism, all these isms that no longer serve us, which is where, you know, the shifts and the uncertainties, like, is because I think in our age we're seeing there's a pushback, and we're saying we it's not working, it really isn't working, and we're going to force you to recognize that it's not working. Nature is doing it through climate change, is saying it's not working. The people are doing it with all these protests, and the protests that are no longer going away. They're like, no, it's not working. Your way is no longer serving us, and we demand something different. We demand that you see us. And it's like going back to nature, like nature can shift, nature can evolve, but in human history, we aren't really evolving as we assume that we are. We're simply still doing the same thing that has been done to maintain a status quo. And I don't know, and it only serves a few, and that's wrong. And those few have somehow convinced a majority, but not all, but have, you know, they've lulled us into this sense of complacency and have instilled a fear of change and what the potential, like, I think the last time there was ever really this. And I'm not a historian, but like around the 60s and the 70s, where, you know, there were, you know, the 60s brought independence for a lot of African nations. The 60s and brought protests against war, you know, the Vietnam War was around that time. The 60s brought Cuban Revolution, you know. But it was quickly squashed. And it's almost like since then, and it was squashed in such a way that was really violent and fearsome, that potentially a lot of those who were around that time, you know, they're now grandparents, I guess, in this day and age. And so they've raised their children to, you know, to just go with the status quo. And there's a lot of that. It's like, you know, there is a flow now. And every, you know, and like I said, every age has the revolutionaries who will who are unafraid to question and push back. And last year, because there wasn't anything holding anybody back, there was no fear of, what about my job? What about this? What about that? And it'd be interesting, like everyone talks about going back to normal, but I don't want to go back to normal because normal hasn't worked. And we've seen that how, like, you know, my daughter's a teenager. It'd be interesting to see the effects of this on her generation as they become adults, because their education has been changed. They experienced education in a way that we had been told wasn't possible. They were working from home, you know. And then, there's also a widening gap because there's so many inequalities, like not everybody has access to data and being able to work online. But they've learned, and, you know, exams are no longer, like for the last 2 years. So last year here in the UK, exams were scrapped. They weren't able to do exams. This year, again, they're unable to do exams. You've got university students whose studies have been interrupted, and they're like, well, we've accumulated all these debts for their loans for a study, for something where actually, if they now look at what the future holds for them, there's no security in their degree being able to sustain a good job for them. And even a lot of them are realizing, actually, the purpose of me studying, if it's to secure a good job, well, it's not really doing that. Universities have proven that they don't do that. So if you're studying at that higher level, it's got to be because there is that pull towards that field of study, and you have that genuine desire to learn more about it and learn more about yourself, which again goes back to what the higher learning institutes were for in the first place. Higher learning was for growth and personal development and for learning and for sharing ideas. But then, like you said earlier about things becoming a commodity, higher learning became a commodity. You know, higher learning used to be free. Governments used to make higher learning, going into university was a free thing that the governments provided. When they decided that that was no longer serving them, it then became a commodity, because then universities became businesses. And in order for a business to survive, you have to have clients, and you have to have your consumers, and the consumers became the students. And so there became a price to studying. And out of that commodity, your consumers ended up with a debt, you know? And the joy of learning becomes lost. From last year, so like from 2020, it's like a lot of the systems. And again, I've talked about education. Then we look at the political system and governance. And last year exposed that the leaders have not been leading in a way that serves the people. It's been self-serving. And they can't hide from that anymore. And they weren't bothering to hide that was their interest, just based on the terms of the policies and the way in which some leaders handled the pandemic in their countries, in their, you know, even do you look at local authorities in terms of how some have been able to manage it better than others. People are beginning to, people are opening their eyes to and opening their minds to the essence of their power, the power of the people's voice.
You know, I have a different perspective. I feel a deep pain and frustration and exasperation. While everywhere else in the world, it really feels like, you know, it's in flames. Singapore, like I think we're doing pretty well handling COVID. We barely have any sort of community transmitted cases. And because everything seems so normal, and that the government really takes pride in us being like sort of the best in handling the crisis, the situation, and because we've got deep pockets and a lot of money in our reserves to be able to afford to tide us through this pandemic. Many people are comfortable to a certain degree. And I don't know if people are even questioning things here. And then when right now I'm trying to understand the business world, the sort of response I get is that we have to strive to be the best, to be the top, to be competitive. So like the new Silk Road that China is building, for example, that extends all the way from like many countries in Southeast Asia, all the way to Europe. You know, yeah, the perspective is always that, you know, this is a good thing. And how can we leverage on that to do business with our Southeast Asian neighboring countries and ride on that so that we can earn money from it? And then I was really questioning, like, what is the environmental impact of that? You are going to uncharted territories, destroying the nature to build that. Is that really providing jobs for people, poor people in developing countries? Is that really lifting them out of poverty? Because apparently, I mean, that's what my lecturer told me, that this is how you can lift, you know, people out of that sort of global poverty, and that there was a need for that sort of trade, that sort of opening of the country for that. But then when I called my Cambodian friend and asked him about it, he was telling me something that was different. He was telling me that, you know, because China lent his country this amount of money and the country couldn't pay back the debt, so they had to give up their port that they're building, and they had to give up the rights to it. So all of the ships or whatever that comes through, like, China has full access and claim to that, the profits from there. And then because of the country being opened up, all of these Chinese businesses were coming into Cambodia. And while they come into Cambodia, they set up their factories or their businesses. They are not hiring local people. They are hiring people from China to come over. They don't even purchase and eat their own food, in the local food. They import it from China. And when it comes to it, property prices rise, expenses rise, living costs rise, people cannot afford that. And then all these small businesses, they like home-based businesses or like farmers, they need microloans to be able to get by or to improve their facilities. And banks are just charging like exorbitant interest rates. So in the end, they lose their land. So what happens when you have like really expensive property prices? People cannot afford to buy a house. They cannot even afford to rent it. And they cannot afford to buy the food that they are eating. You know, Cambodia is a developing country, but my friend was telling me that he thinks Singapore is cheaper than Cambodia. I was so surprised. You know, Singapore is like one of the most expensive places in the world. And he's telling me that Cambodia is even more expensive than here. And it's just like, how has such globalization really benefited people? Whose interest is that? And then another reflection was that the lecturer is someone who works in the UN and with the government and like trade industry, like with the unions and stuff. If this is his perspective, and I'm assuming that, you know, people at that level have this sort of perspective without actually knowing what's happening on the ground, These are decision makers, right?
Well, that's my point. It's like, you know, so through this conversation you had with your friend, and there will only be, like, you know, they're at that top level, but it's on the ground, and that, you know, there will be rumblings on the ground, because, you know, the same thing, you know, is happening across Africa as well with and it, you know, across Africa it changes hands. First it started with, well, I'll only speak of Nigeria, but like, you know, the Lebanese came in and there was trade with the Lebanese, and then it became with Lebanese over, you know, over lands and stuff, then in terms of, and businesses. And then we had a wave, and it was Indians coming in with technology. So a lot of the mobile technology, communication companies and banking areas, you know, there was that whole flux. And then now the next wave is the Chinese coming in. And like you said, like, governments are making these decisions in developing countries that have the resources and the capacity to build themselves out of their situation. But you know, the IMF and the World Bank and these trade deals that they do, it goes back to self-serving. They serve a few. And then on the ground, it is the people that suffer. But like, you've got young people who are fed up and defiantly fed up in a way that they are, like I said, it's that pushback. They will push back and they will speak out. And we've got technology in which they're able to. So they may try and shut down, you know, they try and shut down communications in various parts of the world, whether, you know, they'll try and stop their Wi-Fi and their ability to be able to communicate via all these digital spaces, but they can't contain it, you know. And you've got a generation of young people who are like, actually, let's look back at our heritage and the generations in our family and in our cultures. And okay, so this person has done this and gone through the route and done what, and maybe not everybody, but like, you know, they look back and like, okay, these people have done the traditional things and have pleased, but to what extent? Let's look at the country as a whole and let's look at the benefits to the community as a whole. You know, that sense of individualism is being stripped away. And it's not immediate. It's not going to be immediate, but the seeds are being planted, you know. The seeds are being planted by those who are questioning. The seeds are being planted by those who are questioning and how they're also encouraging and creating spaces for the children that they're having to question and potentially not go down the traditional way. There are ripple effects, and these ripple effects will eventually topple what we're seeing right now. This is the beginnings of the cracks. Yeah. And we just keep on these conversations and, you know, on the ground. And you said it, it's like it is, it's on the ground, and people on the ground, the people on the ground are no longer willing to accept what is being handed to them. And there is a fearlessness that, you know, this can't be, not even with what you're doing, with the questioning, you going into various spaces and questioning, you know, those are seeds being planted, because it might not affect those who you're asking those questions to, but there are people around. Everything is energy. There are people around who are listening and hearing, and they will ponder and be like, wow, why is she asking these questions? They might not agree with it, but it's like, and your questions, if it makes someone uncomfortable, that's a seed being planted with, like, so they may ignore it, or it may get them to, well, why does it make me feel uncomfortable? Is she right? Is she not right? Why will I defend? And they may truly believe in what they're defending. Okay. But then there'll be others who don't, you know?
But, you know, I think the scariest is when they truly believe in what they're defending, because they cannot see any other perspective, and that they genuinely want to do good and they believe that that is their way of doing good. There is this French proverb that says, the highway to hell is paved with good intentions. The older I get, the more I feel like that's really right. And it's just like, in this world that we are in, how many actually really care? And for the young people who care, how can we create a space, create a world where it's easier for them to act, to create that change? Or is that discomfort a necessary part of that process? You know,
change cannot happen without discomfort. Every form of metamorphosis, every form of change involves mobility, it requires a transition from one state to another. It may be smooth or it may be painful, but it involves some friction. It needs that in order for a change to take place. It's whether, it does boil down to like, how do we all feel about in the process of that change? Now, do we tap out when it's too much? And that's okay. For some people, that might be the threshold, the extent to which they're willing to go in the form of the call. And that's, and that's okay. There may be some things that would be upset. And then there are those who will go to the death, like it will be to life. If it's in order for me to see this change, whether it's for themselves, whether it's for the next generation, but like, you know what? I'm going to see it all the way through. And it's not going to be easy at all. And the thing is, you might not even see or reap the benefits in your lifetime, but maybe your children's children would. As long as you are convicted, and things like, some people, and like you were saying about some people, it's dangerous how convicted some people are in their beliefs. On the flip side, they could be saying the same thing about you and I, about how dangerous we are with our convictions. And that's okay for me. That's okay. Yeah. You're going to say something?
Yeah, I've been like reflecting a lot on what way. So as I was chatting with my friend, he was sort of also sharing about how even if young people who care really want to bring renewable energy into Cambodia, it cannot happen because the good friend of the president or whoever's in charge is the person who owns all these the electricity of the entire country, which is not generated through like any sort of renewable or sustainable means. And then, in the end, that's like corruption. That's like politics.
It's not like, it is corruption. It is.
And it's like, how do people fight that, Like, and then he told me that he learned it the hard way, that you have to rise the ranks, you have to climb the ladder and be at a position where you're powerful enough to be able to make a difference. Because otherwise, if you're just like a small fry, no one listens and you can't make a difference. And then I'm hearing so much from people around that, you cannot beat the system by just being in opposition with it. You have to join it and then go through the politics or whatever to get to the position of power where that sort of change can be enacted. And it's like that duality, does it have to be this way? Like, does idealism not get people anywhere? Do we have to compromise?
See, again, it's, power and control. And it's those things like this need for power and this need for control. Because even with, going back to your French proverb about the way to hell being paved by good intentions, you get there, you enter the ranks and you play the game and you rise, and then you get into that position of power and you make those changes as you have been, how you've felt, those changes that you felt should have been made back then, and you finally, it's finally your turn. And that's like a cut, the problem that we have across Africa is that, okay, I said a lot of our leaders there started in the 60s with independence and breaking away from British imperialism. And all their ideals were great for the 60s. And they held on to that and they rose and they did and they fought their way and they got their way. And then they got there, they finally got there, they're at the top, they're in power. And in their rise to make sure that they get to have their say and make the changes that they felt was needed back in the 60s, it's now we're in the 90s. We're now in 2000s. We're now in 2010. We're now in 2020. And a whole decades have passed and decades of systems and changes have taken place, and they've not been aware of those changes. So they're no longer responding to the needs of the people they're serving, their own ideals. And, you know, what drives your need for change? Now, if it is about community, and if it is about people, and if it is about, we've constantly got to check in and making sure that what we're doing serves the needs of the people, and the needs of the people will change all the time. And if we're not responsive to that change, what we are presenting is going to serve only ourselves, because it's what we feel that they need as opposed to what they need. And it's being holistic in the approach. And I find that way of, and you know, of joining, you know, to, in order to beat the system, you have to join the system. You can do that. But I've seen and I've observed, like, over time, the desires of those who lead the change becomes more about themselves, become self-involved. And like I said, it doesn't look at what serves the people. And we've constantly, if you're going to be a leader for change, you've got to lead from behind and look up, you know, because now we're talking about renewable energies and solar, you know, and all of that. And okay, we get there. 10 years, it takes us 10 years to get to the top. But we then we don't realize that actually solar panels and solar generators aren't the way forward anymore. It's something else. But we're insisting that, okay, I'm here now, so it's got to be solar power and renewable energies in that way. And not seeing that there could be new ways are being made and being developed all the time. It's a hard, you know, it is a hard one, like change making. But I feel like power and control, and like going back to like the nature of trees and stuff, like, you know, biodiversity embraces and celebrates the diversity and supports each biosystem in its diversity. It doesn't try and, yeah, doesn't try to dictate or overtake. It works in harmony. It seeks to work in harmony. And we don't try that enough. We have been used to being in opposition to one another in every, you know, like in every level. And we do that in our language. We do that through, whether it's through ages, you know, pitting the young against the old, male against female, tribe against tribe, religion against religion, meat eaters and non-meat eaters, you know, in that we can't find a way to just coexist and be content with coexisting, because no one, like, every individual is unique in their most beautiful and wonderful way, and that's okay, you know. Even in our differences, we don't have to share the same beliefs and understanding, but have a respect for where people are coming from, and be open to hearing a different perspective. And, you know, we seek to communicate to change people's way of thinking and to get them to think like we're thinking. I don't need anybody to think like I am. I'd like for you to hear it and to understand it and to validate it. You don't have to agree with it, but I would like, same way as like, you know, anyone who comes up to me with anything that I disagree with, I respect their point of view. I understand, you know, you've got to look at the bigger picture, look at where they're coming from. I understand where they're coming from. I don't have to agree with it. And you don't have to, and I will state my point of view. They don't have to agree with it. There are things that can be solved easily through facts, and the facts are there. Our systems are flawed. And like I said, our systems are, you know, we're maintaining these systems that have been around. And what would it be like if everything could just be smashed and we start over? Like if we could just press the reset button and just like our ways of governance. Like it would have been nice if last year they, you know, our leaders just like, okay, do you know what? This isn't working. This really isn't working. And this pandemic has knocked us for six, just like it has everybody else out there. We can't govern in this way anymore. So what would it look like if we just like start over? If business worlds have to do it, you know, like businesses who are failing and like, okay, we have to reset. We either go bankrupt or we have to start over. Why couldn't that happen in the political world? Like, okay, this just, I know it's crazy, but maybe we need to call other people into the room because we don't know this. Let's just reset, call other people into the room. What can we do differently? Because already they've already made the people's world uncomfortable by telling us to stay home and to stop working and to stop doing this. You've already gone as far as doing that. What more can you do then to just like, okay, look, come up and to say, look, people, we're going to have to reset. We've already disrupted your lives as it is. But we're working on something different. And yeah, that's me being idealistic possibly, but like they could have done. Everybody else, we've all had to reset. We've all been forced to reset, but there have been certain systems that haven't done. All they're doing is trying to hold on and find a way to do what they have already been doing.
But what if people fear the uncertainty of that potential change much more than the discomfort that they currently feel? Because I sense that even if people feel overworked or that they hate their jobs or that, you know, they hate their work life, they make do with it because it gives them the stability to pay the mortgage or to be able to afford going to restaurants or, you know, these little luxurious things that they can do in their free time. And it's, you know, like listening to the people. But what if people are comfortable to a point in which they don't want to care more, because caring more means that it's going to put them in an even more sort of discomfort. Then who cares about the climate? Who cares about the environment? Who cares about biodiversity? Who cares about these climate refugees, or who cares about other refugees who have had to flee because of war, or who cares about the exploitation that's happening by China, you know, through new colonization? Who cares? And if people are comfortable not caring and they can tolerate that sort of mechanical lifestyle, should we leave them be? And also because the climate crisis, it's something that people don't, I mean, except for some parts of the world, other parts of the world have not seen it, have not really felt it, or have not really feel it in their country or, you know, around them in a state that is severe enough for them to be awakened. I'm speaking about Singapore, even though it is getting slightly hotter, but everything seems like pretty normal. You know, if you wear a mask, you just go out and that's fine. And it's just like this, I also know that it's an incredible sense of privilege to be in a rich country. But then you have such a bubble that fundamentally almost feels like it doesn't care about what's happening outside, as long as we stay at the top, as long as we continue to innovate, as long as we continue to invest in our technology, and as long as we can continue to grow our economy from these technologies. Even if they don't know what this technology that they're innovating is for, they would just, you know, research and innovate it anyway because they want to stay on top. And all that, it's also for investment purposes. It's from a very business perspective, this business point of view. As even if this is going to leave us with a society that is very, you know, rational, logical, logically inclined, and that the arts, humanities, they suffer because there is no place for that. Because, you know, the future is just going to be in tech and Google Analytics or whatever. That's taken as a consensus that it's a sacrifice that the country has to take. And when you have everyone who thinks the same sort of logical way, where the arts cannot flourish, where there is censorship, where people cannot really speak up, and everything has to be done in a very specific way and procedure, I don't know, I feel scared for a future like this, a country like this. Yet that's just taken as, you know, we need to do this to survive and thrive. This is a sacrifice that you just have to swallow and take.
I think we've always, but we, you know, we've always had that though. We've always had, like, you know, people who, there will always be people who are afraid of the change and resistant to the change. And I said, are complacent because they can cope. There are those who have coped and have the discomfort. Their level of discomfort may be in the restrictions, like you said, to their social life and to the things that the leisure that they have been restricted from. But I don't think we can globally, and I can't really speak for Singapore because I don't really know too much about Singapore other than what you've been sharing in our conversations. But I mean, I also see that it's pretty similar to like what I see in Nigeria as well. Like, it will, how can I phrase this? Sense of community, definitely. It all does boils down to sense of community, really. Because how can you be content with your own survival and your own level of comfort at the discomfort of the majority? Because that's what, you know, if for the wider benefit, for there to be some form of a balance, and I'm not talking like in terms of socialism, but just like, okay, not everybody can be on the same level plane. But why should there be a level of poverty and inequality brought about by a system that serves a few and some, but not all, and serving all in a way that is prosperous for all, that isn't at the expense of any one group? Because, I mean, I get it. It will, you know, being able to reset and it will make people even more uncomfortable, fine. But if we look at the bigger picture, and the bigger picture is like, these systems need to be broken down, take what has worked and what is working throw out what isn't working and no longer serves. Let's look at it, and it, but it needs to be changed all the time. It can't be stagnant. And that's kind of like my, I think I'm hoping I'm communicating my point, is that a system can't be stagnant. And we have systems that are stagnant and are insistent on being a particular way, and they're not flexible, and they need to be, because human beings, we change, we diversify, we're different. We've got migration and immigration. We've got our ways of thinking are continually changing. Our ways of being are changing. So therefore we need a system that supports us and governs us, that is adaptable. And what's wrong with that? Like, what's wrong with looking like, you know, it's more than just, oh, let's vote in who we want in every 4 years. It's, okay, where are we at? We, you know, if we as individuals are always self-reflecting, and not everybody, but like, if we can self-reflect to be like, oh, where am I at this year? Or looking at 5 years, like, okay, where am I at now? What's working? What do I want to do differently next year? Why can't we have governance? Why can't we have systems that do that? And it's like, okay, well, okay, let's look around. Let's look at education. What's happening on a national scale? What's happening at a local level? What's working? What isn't working? Okay, how can we ensure that we have an even playing field for everybody? Why must we have, you know, like, what? Why must we have a system that serves, you know, like private schools and all these private institutions that, if you can afford to get into it, pretty much it opens up so many different doors. And if you're not in that circle, you have to work doubly hard. And even if you do find yourself having a scholarship into that circle, you're still not really going to be accepted.
But, you know, I've also learned that we have built governments, organizations, institutions, even companies in these sort of systems and hierarchies that makes it very difficult for change to happen. And because everyone is supposed to just do their part of the work, if they are given more work, or if someone initiates something that's going to give them more work, they have little incentive to want to do that. And it's like, not everyone sees the big picture. And when we have societies that function this way, people don't see more than just their part. Then when it comes to any sort of transformation, be it business transformation, organizational transformation, or like government transformation, political transformation, it's going to be very difficult to get to. I mean, one, in part because of the systems that's in place and the hierarchies that's in place, but two, it's also whether people are flexible and agile enough to change. And then hierarchies often come with power structures.
But we've proven that as a people last year. Like, I work in a school, and so recently, we had, you know, coming back off of our Christmas holidays, school was supposed to resume on the 4th of January. We came in on the Monday, and then that night, Boris Johnson said, no, schools are going to close until March. And that was it. And schools closed. We had, you know, going back even with like last year, when the pandemic hit, and it was like, oh, we're going to do this for lockdown for, no, restaurants will close. March. Oh yeah, restaurants, we're closing down restaurants and businesses. Okay, restaurants and businesses closed. It was uncomfortable, but people had to do it. And they did it. Schools will close. You may be back in after the Easter break. Easter break came, went. So no, schools aren't going to come back. We're going to remain closed, and we'll let you know how it goes. And they kept pushing it. And it was like, you know, complete shutdown. So we've proven, and I said, it's, you know, the fear of change is just a state of mind. And it's so convenient to, you know, to believe that things aren't possible and put it on fear. But human history has shown that changes can be possible. The problem isn't the change, it's the sustainability of that change in a way that is holistic and beneficial to everyone. It's like what I said earlier, it's like the change makers. It's like, yeah, okay, so they succeed in making their change. Does that then mean that they, what do they do to you know, what they do to sustain that change is key, because they may just end up being the same as those that they overthrew, you know, like the change that they overtook. So in order to sustain the change, they become another form of control. They don't want to have, you know, like, we're going to have to sit down and have conversations with people who don't agree with us. We're going to have to sit down and have conversations with people whose advocacy for a system that has been problematic, we may still need them. How can we come together with our differences in a way that is progressive? And it, you know, there was things like taking the ego out of the room, you know, sometimes it's not about what we think should happen. It's like, let's look and see what needs to happen. And sometimes what we think should happen isn't necessarily the first step that we need to take. And there's loads of things that need to be looked at and implemented before we even get to that stage. And even by the time we get to that stage, it might be like, actually, you know what? My idea isn't necessary now, based upon all the changes that we've been making. I don't think my idea is going to work. We could maybe use a bit of it, but I don't think all of my idea is necessary. And be okay to say that. And that's what doesn't happen. You know, it's like with parenting. You know, I constantly, like every year with my daughter's birthday, I have to realize that I've never been the mother of a 16-year-old before. So I've got to be prepared for different things. Every year after I've made myself reset and realize that actually, I don't know what I'm getting into, because she's not been 16 before, and I've not been the mother of a 16-year-old before. So I am going to have to be flexible. And there'll possibly be some things that will stay the same. I've got to be able to let go of some things too. One day she's going to be 30. And I'll be like, I've never been a mother of a 30-year-old before. So, I mean, that doesn't change. Me being a mother doesn't change. But she grows every year. And I've got to adapt my parenting to that. And likewise with her too. I always often say to her, like, hey, look, I'm getting older. So what you knew of me, just study. I learned that with my mom as well, actually, just kind of like looking at her as a person and be like, okay. And if we dealt with one another by really truly looking at each other and understanding and recognizing our strengths and our weaknesses and how we can complement one another, as opposed to controlling, perhaps we can create systems that serve everything in our sphere. But the need, and you know, a lot of things are driven by the need to control rather than lead or guide.
So what is the thing that people can do to create change in the world?
That's a really, that's a tough question. But what resonates for me with that question is love, a return to love, and love in the sense that agape love, the unconditional love that seeks to serve, that seeks to give, that seeks to understand. A love that's not about control, and that can, that is compassionate and is healing and above all else forgiving. Love that creates the space for change to take place, because in order for change to take place, people are going to have to make mistakes. And when people make mistakes, we've got to be forgiving of those mistakes and giving them the space to be able to pick up and start over again. But if we love in a way that is conditional and is not accepting of flaws and failures, then we're not going to see any change. In order for change, you've got to make a mistake. You've got to fail. And you've got to be comfortable with failing. You can't be perfect. There's no such thing as perfection. So love.
What's next for you?
What is next for me? So, due to the pandemic, my organization, Rocks, ceased trading. Everything stopped. And with everything stopping, it brought up a lot of challenges. So I've had to reset and starting over. So in terms of for Rocks, it's just starting over and what that looks like. I'm not trying to recreate what I started, but yeah, starting over, starting again, starting afresh. For me immediately, well, this week is half term, so I get to rest. I work in a school, so I teach. So yeah, this week is also about me doing my lesson plans for my art classes. Using this week to connect and share space with my daughter. Still creating. I'm still working on the folktale, so illustrations to go along with it. Still making, still writing, resting, hopefully. more conversations. And yeah, that's it, I think.
Would you be able to end this episode off by sharing your folktale?
Sure. The tale of 2020. One winter's eve, when the sun colored the skies like flames twirling in the fires of burning logs, the winds tickled beneath coats with icy fingers. A mother and her children stood in the forest. "Can you tell me a story?" a child asked the mother. "The winds are quite strong and the night is coming, but I can try before it is time to rest for the night," the mother replied. "Yes, thank you," said the child. The mother began the tale. "One morning, many, many moons before..." "Is it the one when the bird set fire to the forest by mistake?" asked the child excitedly. "No," said the mother. She began again. "One morning, many, many moons..." "Is it when the fox tricked the badger?" asked another child. "No," said the mother, and was silent. Sorry, said that child.
Thank you, replied the mother.
Did you want those stories? She asked that child.
Not really, if this is a new story.
Will it be a new story? One you haven't told before? They asked. Suddenly, a strong wind tugged the children's hold on the mother. The children held on tightly and relaxed in the embrace of the mother's arms. And as the clouds began to darken and the sun descended, the mother began her story again. One morning, many, many moons passed, when great-great Koko was your cycle, is the last that year far and day wandered throughout our earth. Then the people used numbers to measure time, and it was known as the year 2020. The child asked, why did they use numbers? We know changes of time by the passing of the moon and the cycle of life and death with each season. The people did too. Perhaps it was not enough for the people. They were always wanting more, replied the mother, and continued the story. That year, a terrible sickness spread across the earth. The leaders of their nations could not control it and declared the people had to stay in their homes. Of course, not everyone could stay home. They needed their healers, teachers, and workers of the land to continue their work. But most had to stay in their homes. Some could continue their work at home, many could not. Some were able to cope and provide for themselves or families, many could not. Some survived the disease, many did not. And the cries of the many and the cries of those the many left behind upon their deaths awakened year far and day. I can see you're wondering who is year far and day. But I can tell you that it is not a person. No age has been certain, and neither has been wrong in their understanding of what it is. Some people feel it, some become it. Some definitely do not like it and will do their best to fight it. Until then, there had been no record of year, far, and day, but it existed and has always been, but many of the people could not feel it. But few could. And there had been times in the people's history when the few challenged the leaders of nations to lead with compassion and be better, but always their voices were silenced, but not that year of 2020. In that year, the voices of the few struck like a pebble across the lake, and the rippling effect was too powerful for the leaders of the nations. The eyes of the people were opened. They saw. They had always seen the injustice, the poverty, the destruction, and the pain, but this time they could not be divided. They learned to unlearn and listen to one another's needs and rose. They kept rising and rising, defying the pull that their way of living had held them captive, and kept rising until they broke free. So everything became perfect? A child asked. No, the mother replied, not in the beginning. And even now in our time. I don't understand, said the child. In that year, and seasons after, they learned to let go and found a new freedom. They walked among us, and the more they walked, the closer we connected. The closer we connected, their hearts became wiser. They believed and had confidence in hope. This confidence saw acts of cooperation between the people that saw beyond their differences. Together they fought to support the weak among them in every way imaginable. They would gather together to remember, to forgive, to mourn, and to honour the lives of the fallen. They listened and remembered we are all connected. They paid attention and heard the rhythm of life. And the more they listened, they grew in confidence and a new symphony was composed. Of course, not everyone wanted this change, and tried every way possible to stop this shift from happening. And the more they fought to keep things the way they knew, the louder the people played, and their voices rose in harmony, and the melody soothed, and the movements healed, the lyrics strengthened, and the art empowered. The balance of change swayed back and forth, twisting and turning until the scales broke. Oh no, did they try and fix it? Asked the children. Some tried to, answered the mother, and each time they succeeded, the chaos stirred until the last time the scales broke, and they left it broken. Another gust of wind curled around the mother and her children. The clouds had now darkened, and their surroundings gently whispered that night had arrived. It was time to rest. So what happened? They asked the mother. Nothing. They left it broken, she said. Like us, they learned to trust the changing seasons. The end.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, Onions Talk listeners. Thank you so much for listening. If you liked what you heard, it would really help if you can leave a review on iTunes or like us on Facebook. Otherwise, subscribe and share it with people whom you think will enjoy this. Special thanks to Andrea for the music. Catch you next episode.